Yeah. So Ecclesiastes chapter 3 is one that you guys probably are pretty familiar with. It's spoken a lot on at funerals and things like that. And when I start reading it, you guys will recognize it. To everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up and to pluck what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. Now before we go any further, the thing that's misinterpreted about this statement that Solomon's making right here is that people think, and it is true, that God purposes every season of your life, both the bad ones and the good ones, and he's always using it to produce something in you. Okay, so even in the times of uncertainty, the times of doubt, the times of bad things, basically, the times of trials and tribulations, God's trying to turn you into something, someone who can reflect his glory and the attribute of his love. So in all these things that you're going through, there is a purpose, there's a plan, but that's not what Solomon's getting at with this whole list. And there's a reason why it's so long. You know, he could have just ended it with just everything, there's a season and a time for purpose, moving on. But instead he goes through this really long list, and the reason why he does that is because in Hebrew poetry, this actually reads as monotony. In other words, what he's saying is like everything that you do is going to be undone, so it's all useless. So if you were really going to read it in the way it's supposed to be read, it would be read like this. Time to weep, time to laugh, time to mourn, time to dance, time to cast away stones, time to gather them, time to embrace, time to refrain from embracing, time to gain, time to lose. You guys get the point, right? It's useless. You know, you just go through the thing and you're just like, okay, there's going to be a time where you're going to do something really cool, and then that thing is just going to get wrecked by someone else. So you might as well not even do it. Because like we talked about, the whole theme of this book is life is vanity. It's all useless. Because the refrain of this book is life under the sun, life devoid of God. We're going to go into life without a creator. This is life, if it just is all cosmic accident, this is what the world has to be. Okay? So Solomon goes through and says, life has to be useless without God. Because you can even see it in your life. No matter how much you do for yourself, no matter how much I eat right now, I'm going to get hungry again, right? I can never get done with that. It's monotony. I'm going to eat again. No matter how much I drink, I'm going to get thirsty again. No matter how much pleasure and joy I have now, tomorrow all of it could be taken away from me like that. You know, so the more you build up, the more you're going to fall, is basically what Solomon is trying to get at. You know, verse 9, what profit has the worker in which he labors? See, that's how you know that that's what he's talking about. He's saying, man, you're going to labor for all this stuff. You're going to labor for love. You're going to labor for relationships. You're going to labor for people to approve of you. And guess what? In the end, they're not going to give a crap about you. That's just the end. So get used to it. I have seen the God-given task with which sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. So in this little section right here, he points out something cool. He reflects back to God. Okay, then he goes right back into monotony. But he says this. He says, God makes everything beautiful. And that's a very intense line, and we're actually going to get back to it. We're going to come back to it in a little bit and really go over like what kind of God we serve and why that's important. But he also says, he answers his question that he's been asking throughout this entire book. Why don't things satisfy me? If I'm a human being, if life is just coincidence and there's really no purpose or meaning or anything like that, why is there a longing in my heart for something more than what I have? You know, it doesn't make any sense. Why is there a need for eternity? And everything dating back to the beginning of man, you see people and their religious beliefs trying to determine an eternity that's to come. And that, from a scientific perspective, that doesn't make any sense. Because if there is a longing placed within you, then it was something that was created through evolutionary process. And so it would have to be something that contributes to your survival instincts. Okay? So if I have a longing inside my heart, logically, that would mean there would have to be something that can satisfy that longing, right? That just makes logical sense. If it's been evolved within me, then it would have to be satisfied. I have a longing for food, so there's food that I can eat. I have a longing for water, so there's water I can drink. I have a longing to sleep, so there's places I can sleep. I have a longing to dwell in a shelter, so I could build a shelter for myself, right? All these things make sense, and all those things make sense from a survivalistic mentality, right? Human beings, we don't deal well with the harsh environments, so we have a longing to be in sheltered environments, so we have the ability and hands to make it, right? So from an evolutionary perspective, that makes sense. It makes no sense whatsoever if we are the product of coincidence, that we would desire an eternity. It is a useless desire. It provides no profit for us in the here and now, and it actually takes away from our survivalistic mentality. And the proof, we don't even have to look very far for the proof, right? Look at these people who believe that their eternity is bought through their own death. Because of the belief of Islamofascism, which is not Islam, I'm not saying that Islam in and of itself is this pure evil religion, it's not. But the people who take the writings of Muhammad and the way that he acted seriously, they can only take the one logical conclusion. And we have to fight and die for our belief system. So because of that, we have all the turmoil that we have in the Middle East. Okay, because of the longings that are within, say, the Buddhists, they're not going out and reproducing and doing what would make sense in nature. They're instead going into themselves and finding inner peace. It doesn't make any sense that we yearn for an eternity. It takes away from our ability to survive. So again, that's why Stalin and Hitler and people with that ideal, that mentality of communism and fascism and things like that, that's why they said the first thing we have to do is we have to wipe out religion. That is the first thing we have to do. If a communistic regime is going to reign, we have to wipe out the religion because it takes away from people the ability to serve the common good, the ability to make this country function. Because if they believe in eternity, then they have a hope outside of what they're doing, and thus they're going to live for the church and not for the government. So we have to wipe them out. And that's what they did, right? Look at Pol Pot, man, the killing fields in Vietnam, in Cambodia and Laos. And look at Kim Il-sung. Look at Mao Zedong. Look at Stalin, Lenin, all these dictators. And I know a lot of you probably don't know who I'm talking about, but the common thread of all these people is they're massively, there's mass killers. They killed millions upon millions of people for the sake of their own goals. For the furtherment of the human race is what they said, what they thought. That's how they justified it. And if you think that kind of thinking hasn't come into America, you're wrong. There was the Planned Parenthood movement started by people like Margaret Sanger back in the day. It was a movement called eugenics that thought we could purify the human gene by wiping out useless genes. So they targeted black and Hispanic communities, and they try to push Planned Parenthood agendas on them so that we could stop the mass reproduction of these people that is hindering the growth of the superior races. That was their thought process. And from an evolutionary thought process, that makes sense. You know, so now we see, what is life without God? It's meaningless. But life without God, life with God, is a pursuit of eternity. Life, if God exists, then there is an eternity. And our hope and our purpose on this earth is to pursue eternity and eternal things. Because if infinity exists, then the finite things lose their purpose. They lose their necessity, right? And that's what Solomon is trying to get at. Everything's useless but eternal things. God makes eternal things, and we pursue temporal things. See, that's useless. It's not going to get you anywhere. Okay, in the end, eternity compared to 90, 100 years, however long we're going to live on this earth, is nothing. It's not even a drop in the bucket. And like we talked about last time, and no one's going to remember you after you die. That's an unfortunate fact that you're going to have to wrestle with. After you die, maybe in 20, 30 years after you pass away, no one will remember your name. Isn't that sad? Just like think about that. It's going to be gone. You're going to be a distant memory. All the people who know you personally and intimately will have already forgotten about you. That's just the way it is. You know, and only if there is a hope of eternity does your life have any value or meaning. Because if there is a hope of eternity, then guess what? You have eternal value. You have such eternal value that someone with the ultimate value was willing to trade his life for yours. That's what he said your life was worth. He said, man, your life isn't worth a bull or a goat. That's not sufficient. Your life isn't worth even the life of another human. That's not sufficient either. Because that's a finite temporal thing. Because you're eternal, you need an eternal sacrifice. Which is why Jesus Christ is the only one who could take our sins away. See, that changes things, doesn't it? It changes my ability to live. It changes the things that I put in my priorities. Okay? But if I don't have that, then I have to live without eternity in mind. I'm going to live for the now. What's going to satisfy me right now? You know, and the writers in the New Testament, they also go over this fact. When I was a child, I thought as a child, right? I did childish things. But now that I'm a man, I put away childish things. How do children think? Children think about the now, right? what's going to satisfy me right now? I've never offered a kid candy and had him be like, oh, I don't know, I'm watching my weight, you know? I don't want to get diabetes, that I don't want any of that, you know, right? They don't think long term. They think about what's going to satisfy me right now. And some people never grow up. That's why pornography is so rampant in America. What's going to satisfy me right now? Ignore the fact that I could have lasting satisfaction in a working marriage. I want what satisfies me right now, and I'm going to neglect the consequences of what I'm doing. And why is America so obese? Because we want what satisfies us right now. And ignore the fact that obesity-caused illnesses is the number one cause of death, and that it's eventually going to kill you. The way that you eat is shaving years off your life. But you are so ingrained in the now that you don't think about the then. Man, it's sad, you know? But God is trying to take away that mentality in your life. He's trying to move your perspective from the temporal to the eternal. And when you do that, it's the people who truly understand the things I do today are going to echo for eternity. They have lasting impact. They matter. I matter. The things and the choices that I do will change everything. I have free will. It's a gift that my Father gave me. But again, if you're an atheist, you can't believe in free will. You're a product. You can never rise above what you were raised to become. That's a very sad way to live. Now, I'm going to try to get through four chapters today, so we've got to keep going. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all. And this is a repeated phrase throughout the thing. Man, I should be satisfied in just what I have, because striving is vanity. So I should just be satisfied with what I have, but I can't be. And notice that he says after that thing about eternity, except no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end. He's like, man, God is eternal. Everything in God is good. Being satisfied in God is good, except I can't have this. I am unable to attain to that way of living. I can't live for eternity. And when you're really honest with yourself, you'd say the same thing. I can't. I know that this thing is hurting me, but I can't give it up. That's why addiction's so sick. I know this thing is killing me and everything around me, but I can't stop doing it. And unless you've been in addiction, you don't understand that. And it's a really scary place to be at. Man, but so that's what Solomon's basically saying. I know this is right, but I can't do it. In myself, in my flesh, I am incapable of doing it. It goes on in verse 14. I know that whatever God does, it should be forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken away from it. God does it that men should fear before him. That which has already been and what is to be has already been. And God requires an account of what is past. What he's saying is, again, God is eternal. The things that he does matter. The things that we do, not so much. Okay? God does things that matter. The things that I can do in myself, in my flesh, they amount to nothing. That's what John 15 says. Essentially, I'm the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. So Jesus says. And all the acclaim that you get to ultimately amounts to wood, hay, and stubble when it's praised by the Father. It's going to be burned. It's going to count for nothing. And so if you want a life of meaning, you have to serve the one who gives it meaning. You have to follow his things. And he gives an account for it. Now, verse 16. Moreover, I saw under the sun. So again, we're looking at a naturalistic perspective. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. There's a time for every purpose and for every work. Okay? And I know that this is something that we can see in our own world. Man, why do the wicked prosper? Right? Psalm 73. Why do the wicked prosper? It's not that the wicked are doing kind of all right for themselves, and I can see that. He's like, it's almost like God is blessing the wicked abundantly. The people who don't deserve money have the most money. The people, the most wicked people on the planet have the most money, and that's true. That's just a true fact. The people who have the most money, guess what? They're the oil people overseas that are going to use their money, all the money that we use and we pool together in America to give to them. They're going to use it to build their own private islands. They have customizable islands in Dubai and things like that that they could literally build with indoor ski resorts and things like that. And I'm not making that up. That's legitimate. You can look it up online. They're pretty sweet looking. But like, so the most wicked people who just pool their resources for themselves and it's all about them, they're the ones who have all the money. 1% of the population has the majority of the money in the U.S. Isn't that weird? And all of us are just working for nothing. Man. And it's like the wicked get the most. the righteous get the shaft. That's what Solomon's observing. And it's kind of funny when he writes that, because who was blessed more than Solomon? No one. So he's actually looking at his own life and is like, this is not just. The fact that I have all this money is not just. There are better people than me, and I have all the resources. And he's actually looking at this as like, man, this is kind of messed up. If God was just, I wouldn't have anything. And again, if it's under the sun, if there's nothing but what is here, then he's right. Life is without justice. Life is without justice. It's completely void of all justice. Okay, but if there is a God, verse 17, I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. For there is a time, there for every purpose and for every work. So he's saying, if there is a God, though, there is justice, because there is a judgment that is coming after this life for what you have done in this life. And you guess what? You don't have to wait till this life is over for you to get your judgment. Did you know that? The more you build up in the temporal, the more you realize it's vanity. That's what Solomon realized. So you may look at these rich people and be like, man, if I only had that, I'd be happy. I'd be so satisfied if I lived a life like that. But all those people are massively depressed. Actors and actresses are on antidepressants. And they're just drinking their problems away. They're trying to sleep their problems away. They're trying to do everything they can to get rid of this anxiety, this gnawing impulse inside of them that says there's something more, but they can't find it. Because it's not in charity. It's not in philanthropy. It's not in doing good deeds. It's not in relationships. It's not in approval. And all these things that we think are so good. Man, if only people liked me, then I'd be satisfied. Man, if only these people loved me, then I'd be satisfied. If only I had this relationship work out, then I'd be satisfied. If only I had this amount of money. If only I didn't have any debt. If only I lived by myself. If only I was out of school. Then finally things would start working out. But Solomon says, man, keep chasing the rainbow, man. You're never going to get to the end. You're never going to get to the end because you're never going to have enough. But if you follow God, you can be satisfied right where you're at. You can be the man that he describes in verse 12. That is satisfied with the good of his labor today. I could look at God and be like, man, today is the day that you have made. I'm going to rejoice and be gratified in you. No more self-gratification. No more seeking other people to fill the need inside of my life. Now I finally have the ultimate fulfillment in God. And now I could look at my relationships and be like, I'm not going to take anymore. I'm not going to be someone who's always seeking to change you to gratify me. I'm going to change me to gratify you. And I'm going to count that my joy. That's my gratification, is seeing your joy and seeing you with God. And that's the ultimate satisfaction. But it takes God to place that desire inside of your heart, to reveal the necessity for himself. It takes him to place that within you. He goes on, though. Verse 18, I said in my heart concerning the condition of the sons of men, God tests them that they may see that they themselves are like animals. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them, as one dies, so the other. Surely, they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirits of the animals, which goes down to the earth? So I perceive that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for what is his heritage? That's a very sad statement. He's saying your works are your heritage. That's all you have. Because you're no better than an animal. Isn't it funny? He wrote this 3,000 years ago. And it took scientists 2,000 years to catch up. More than 2,000 years. Almost 3,000 years to catch up to what Solomon said 3,000 years ago. Just recently, within the last half century, scientists have finally been like, man, maybe we're just like animals. Prior to that, they never even thought that for a second. They're like, no way. Humans are way better than animals. Well, why? Because we are. What makes a human better than an animal? What gives us intrinsic value? If there's no creator, then we're just slightly more evolved. That's it. We're just smarter than other animals. That's the only reason why we have any value inside of our lives. But if you look at it that way, then you really don't have a value. Okay, because the only value attributed to a species is how good it is for the common good, right? And if that's the truth, then guess what? Humanity is the greatest blight that this world has ever seen. We have done more damage to this world than any other species before us and probably after us. Because of us, man, forests are being cleared out, the ozone layer is being depleted. Man, we now have the tools to wipe out almost everything because of our existence. So guess what that means? That means that you have less value than an animal. Because at least they're not destroying everything. You know? And if you go to members of PETA and things like that, they would totally agree with that statement. They're like, yeah, animals are peaceful. And I mean, yeah, they fight, but they only kill one or two at a time. We humans, we commit mass genocide. We murder thousands at a time. We murder millions at a time. We are worse than any animal. We are the worst things that could ever exist on this planet. We need to be wiped out. For the existence of this earth to continue, human beings need to be destroyed, is what they would say. Solomon agrees. 3,000 years ago, someone already thought this up. And he's like, yep, this is exactly how it is. The only way that we have value is, guess what? God breathed life into you to make you a living soul. He never did that with any of the other animals. He gave you eternal value. He gave you a soul that's going to last from here to eternity. He knit you together in the womb. He saw you before you were formed. He knew you intimately before the foundations of the earth, and he looks upon you as precious. Without him, though, all that value goes to nothing, and you have no value. Okay? And this is something that hits my heart really hard, because, you know, something in my life that some of you know, but I've never gotten really into too much detail with you guys about it before. Because of what I've been through in my life, I developed an ability to devalue human life, to devalue it to the point where I didn't care. Okay? And it was part of my training, but it was something that I latched onto because I thought it was cool. You know, I thought killing someone would be something beneficial. So I pressed into that idea. And the first thing they teach you when you're about to go over is how to dehumanize somebody. Okay, so we do things in training. Like, we'll shoot targets that look like a human. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about violence consistently. We'll always be thinking, man, how do I kill somebody? What are the pressure points? What are the ways that I can shut somebody down and murder them? You know, and if you ever talk to a veteran from any war, you'll never hear them say things like, oh, yeah, they got Afghanistani people. Yeah, or a World War II veteran would say, oh, the Germans or the Japanese. They would never use their proper terms because they teach you not to do that. And the reason is because if you think of them as a person, you can't kill them because there's something inside of you that says that's wrong. But if I think of them as, oh, it's just a haji, it's a subspecies, it's not even a human, then all of a sudden I could kill it without any remorse in my heart. Notice I said the word it. It's not a person anymore. See, and that's what they do to us, because when we go there, guess what? I had to see people die every single day. And if I thought of them as people, I couldn't have been able to make it through. So I had to dehumanize them. And I did it with joy. Because I'm sick. And I'm wicked. And I'm twisted. And I thought it was funny. And I thought it was a game. See? And because of that wickedness that resides inside of me, I understand. I understand exactly what God had to go through to save someone like me. And because I'm willing to look at myself in that standpoint, I'm able to show grace to other people in a way that I couldn't before. See, the pornography thing in my life, that was a big sin. But that didn't surprise me as much as my sin in this area. This sin really shook me. And when I came back and I started talking to people about things like this, and I honestly thought in my head, man, I think it's funny when people die. I think it's amusing to see it happen. See, I think it was one of my, not my friends, someone I knew. I didn't like him. I didn't like him at all. He got blown up, and he lost both of his legs. And the first thought that popped into my head was, well, at least it wasn't someone I liked. That's a good thing. And at least he took the shot for someone else. You know, because that's how wicked I am. You know, that thought process, that knowledge of who I am, I don't want to seek me anymore. You know, so many people, they say, man, I just want to find myself. That's such a selfish thing to say. But you want to find yourself because you don't understand how wicked you are. And until you look inside and you realize, man, I'm no better than anybody else. And I do deserve the death. The world would be a better place if people like me didn't exist. It really legitimately would. I am sick and depraved, and I don't deserve a savior. But even in the utmost of my depravity, God looked at me and said, man, I want to give my life for that guy. I want to not only save him from the consequences of the wickedness in his heart, but I want to transform his heart to see things the way that I do, to see life with value, to see things as beautiful. Like I told you, I was going to come back to the whole thing about beauty. God makes everything beautiful in its time. If you look through all the deities throughout human history, all the ones that we have created, you know, whether it's Greek mythology, North mythology, Canaanite mythology, all those gods are so superior to humans that they don't look at human life as valuable. They look at human sacrifice as a good thing. They look at war as a good thing, something that they want to happen. You know, they're very bloodthirsty. Okay? And there's a movie that came out, I don't recommend it, but I'm not even going to mention it, actually, the name, but there's a guy in the movie who gets transformed into something like a god. He's able to manipulate matter, and he becomes basically like a god. And at one point, they tell him that one of his friends dies, and he goes, well, you know, on a cellular level, a dead body and a live body are exactly the same, so I see no difference. He became so superior that he looked at human life as not valuable, and then he ends up going to Mars, and they tell him, well, you should save the world. He goes, why? Look at this. This landscape is so beautiful. How could it be improved by a shopping mall or an oil pipeline? So, man, maybe life is better without existence. That's what he says. And we in a human philosophy, we would say that that's true. Man, if there is a God, he would be so much more superior to us that he couldn't look at human life as valuable. And that's why war happens, you see? God is just some distant person who doesn't really care about you. Okay? He cares about his planet, kind of, but you are so small and insignificant, how could he possibly care about you? So even at our best, Solomon's like, even at the best possible thing, we have a God who doesn't even care. Okay? Worst possibility is that there is no God, and that nothing really matters. Best possibility, there's a God who doesn't care. But he says that, man, our God's different. God sees beauty in things. God is pleased with his people, Psalm 149. God sees value in every human life. God wants to do things to preserve you, to move you forward. He has a plan and a purpose for you. Specific purposes for you. And no matter how wicked you see yourself now, he can change you into something else. He can sanctify that wickedness and make it something beautiful in its time. There's a patience that comes. It doesn't happen overnight. I didn't see people the right way overnight. It took time to develop that, to forget that old mentality that I had, and to move forward into something else. It took time to understand. But that time is something precious to me now because I saw how God was working through every single day, every single season. I don't regret any of it. And I would go through it again because I see the end and it's better than the means. And chapter 4 starts out like this. Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors, there is no power. There is power, should I say, but they have no comforter. Therefore, I praise the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. And so Solomon looked at it and said, man, life is monotony. There is no justice. Without God, there is no justice. The oppressors, they oppress people with power, and yet even they suffer and don't have comforters. There's no comfort for anybody. And in your life, man, you're going to see when things really go bad, trials really hit you, you're going to see how inadequate your friends and family are going to be at comforting you. Because no matter how much they try, they can't take away the pain. No matter what words they say to you, it's going to be insufficient for you. Because there's only one person who can comfort you. Because there's only one person who intimately knows you in a way that can make things better. And sometimes he uses people to help, but ultimately the comfort comes from him. But if he doesn't exist, then there is no comfort. You just have to suck it up and keep moving on with your life. Because there's nothing better than to be satisfied in what you're doing. And again, I saw for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied in his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better a handful with quietness than both hands fold together with toil and grasping for the wind. So Solomon, interesting, the man with everything, he envied people. Isn't that weird? This guy who had everything, he's like, man, I wish I was just a farmer, man. I wish I just had like one hand full. I'm sick of having both hands full and having to work and work and work. This sucks. I would rather just be a peasant because at least those guys could just be satisfied with what they do because the grass is always greener. We on the bottom think it's better on top. The people on top think it's better on the bottom because no one's ever satisfied. Okay, when you get to the top, guess what you realize? The more I have, the more I have to take care of. And if I have a lot of money, guess what? I have to take care of all that money. And I have to worry about increased amount of taxes. And I have to worry about who's going to be in office because that's really going to affect my finances. And I have to worry about my job. And I have to worry about the people who work for me. And I have to worry about all these things that are affected by my money because I have chosen to pursue something that's ultimately vanity. And that's where Solomon's at. Man, I have all these things, but guess what? Everyone looks to me. And I have all this responsibility. And I don't like it. I would rather have nothing and not have this burden than to have everything with the increased amount of burdens that I have. Money will not satisfy. Power doesn't satisfy. Reputation doesn't satisfy. The more friends you have will not satisfy you. Because guess what? You get a lot of friendships. You have to preserve those friendships. And you have people that care about you in your life. You're always thinking, man, well, what if I do this? And then they're going to hate me. And then I have to hang out in this way. And I have to do these things. And I have to change myself to be pleasing to them or else I'll lose them. Because my value is in something that's waning. But if my value is in God, then even if everyone leaves me, I still have everything. Because God will never leave me nor forsake me. See, that's something that's different, right? When I returned, I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother. Yet there is no end to all his labors. For his eye is satisfied with riches, but he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and great misfortune. So it's talking about someone who's just preserving his own life. He doesn't have any family. No one's going to get passed on all that he does. So he says, man, that's useless because you're just working for yourself. Verse 9 says, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift them up, or lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he who has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can we be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. So Solomon again goes back to atheism, okay? This is life without God, okay? Life without God logically makes sense for you to have a community around you. And I actually talked to my brother about this, and this is actually what they believe. They think the reason why humanity evolved compassion and caring for one another, why good morality is a good thing to have, because an atheist today can't say, just do whatever makes you feel good and be happy. And just, you know, if you're wicked, be wicked, don't worry about it. Because they can't say that, because that would completely just erupt their arguments, because people would be like, well, that's stupid. And you have people like Hitler just going off and doing everything that they want to do, and there's no consequences. So we can't do that. So there has to be some sort of order. So why do we have order? So they came up with a solution. The reason why we have order is because without order and morality, society crumbles. And if society crumbles, humanity doesn't do well. We do better as a pack. We do better with other people around us. So their whole reasoning for acting good and things like that is like, well, it's good for survival. It's better that we act this way. Because without it, then society would collapse. But, I mean, I asked my brother, I was like, survive for what, man? Like, what are you trying to perpetuate here? You know, Solomon even says, man, after you, you don't know the things that are going to happen after you. And maybe you're perpetuating a society that needs to die. And maybe this is actually harmful to other people, you know? You can't. And why are you perpetuating society? And I even asked him, are you happy with the things that you're doing? Is being good to people, does that make you feel good? Or does it just leave you more empty? And he honestly told me, he goes, no, I'm not happy. I have no joy. But he didn't care. Like, man, he said, such is the curse of the knowledge of existence, is what he told me. And that's sad. I have no pleasure, but that's only because I evolved to the place of knowing that I exist. And that's just a burden to me. But I just keep moving past it because it's better that the society exists. So I'm just going to be a servant to everybody. And my life is meaningless. But even though this is something that we could look at from survivalistic mentality, it could also be applied to us as Christians. We in the body, in Galatians, it says, man, bear one another's burdens. Even an atheist could see the need for being a community. Even an atheist can see the need for leaning on each other, for support and for blessing, you know, for desiring companionship. Even an atheist can see that. Why is we a church? Why can't we see that? Because the more we go along the church, the more we isolate ourselves. We say that we're nothing without God. We say that, yeah, we're all sinners, but how many people are comfortable confessing their sins? But they don't. Why? Because they think they're going to be judged. So obviously we don't really understand that it is better to have multiple people, because how can you truly be intimate with someone if you have secrets? If you have things in the darkness of your heart that you're just not willing to tell them, because obviously you don't trust them, because if you did trust them, you would tell them. But you're afraid to come into the light because you're afraid of being judged, or you're afraid of being mocked. See, we as Christians, we should know this better than anybody. We should know this passage and be like, yeah, you know what? A threefold cord is not broken easily. Man, I want to fight my flesh. I need to get into a community. I need to start confessing to people so they can help me and pray for me. Man, so that, man, we're all wicked, so it shouldn't surprise them if I tell them that I struggle in these areas. And so I want them to help me out so I could get out of this pit that I've been digging in for my entire life. I want to see things better, man. And if I want to stand up against my wicked temptations, maybe I need help from a community. We should understand that, but we don't. And we don't act like that. And that's why when you go to the Tuesday groups and the Thursday groups and stuff like that, it's very secretive. There's people that come, but they come from different churches and things like that because they don't want to talk about it in their own church and their own fellowship. They want to talk to people that they don't know and who won't tell their community how they struggle. And we keep things inside, and we may confess to people around us, but they're not full confessions. We don't actually tell them what's actually going inside of our heart because we're afraid. And we're afraid. And it's very sad that we act that way. And because he even says, right, how can you stay warm alone? If you lie down alone, how are you going to stay warm alone? How can you stay on fire, passionate for Jesus Christ, unless you have people in your life that are going to motivate you forward? You know? This is you trying to find a zeal for God. Man, but it's so easy to lose that and become cold. It's so easy to lose that and become cold. But when you have a community of people who cares about God just as you do, then it makes things a lot easier. And you're sharing each other's burdens. You're lightening each other's loads. And I look at people who are more passionate about God than I am, and that motivates me to be more passionate about God. And I look at people who are maybe just like learning these things that I know. And they're coming forward, they're coming to where I'm at, and I want to be more passionate for their sake. Because I want them to grow in the knowledge and the love of God that I have for Him. And I have found satisfaction. I have found contentment. I have found true treasure and joy. Why wouldn't I want to share that with people? You know, why wouldn't I want to share that with people who should see the things the way that I do? A joy shared is twice a joy, and a grief shared is half the grief. And this should be something that we always do. And even men struggle with this more than anything. We struggle with being broken in front of other men. I don't want to tell people that I actually struggle with things. I don't want to tell people that I'm weak, because then they may view me differently, right? I don't want to tell people that I'm depressed and sad because I want to be strong. I want to bottle all that up. I don't want to just keep moving because that's what being a man is all about. That's not true. When God looks at someone who does that, who seeks his own, who moves inside of himself, he sees a fool. He sees someone who is weaker than anyone else. He says true strength comes from vulnerability, transparency, and honesty. You want to be strong in God? Learn about his body. And be free and free to share within the body, the bride of Christ, that you could be unified going towards God. And, but it's more important to me to look a certain way. So even at the times that people confess, it's funny, even the times in the Tuesday group and things like that, place where they're like, man, this is a place to confess. It's funny how months later, someone will be like, well, you know, I didn't fully confess. You know, I also had all this other stuff going on. I said, dude, why did you wait months? You knew we weren't going to judge you. What are you trying to hide from, man? If you come in this room, we know you're a porn addict. That's why you're here, okay? Why would I judge you for saying something that I already know, right? It's completely foolish, but we're still, even in the avenue of confession, we're still nervous about confessing. And because it's so hard for us to grab a hold of this truth. It's so hard for us to seek this joy and betterment in God. God wants you to grow. He wants you to abundantly and excessively grow in Him and in love for other people. But you can't do that unless you let your guard down. And that's something that's beautiful, man. I hope you guys are starting to grab that in your own lives. Verse 13, better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. Yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity, grasping at the wind. So what Solomon is saying, dude, people have a short memory. People have a really short memory. And you may do something really awesome for someone, and in a couple days he's going to forget, and no one's going to care. You know? back when I came out, back from Afghanistan, me and my friends had egos, like just huge egos. We're like, man, we're awesome, you know? We went out, we served our country, everyone's going to love us. We came back, most people were nervous around me, and most people just didn't even care what I did. And it's like Neil Armstrong, he's back from the moon and no one cares. Like, it's just, no matter how great a thing you do, people are going to forget. And it's just the value of what you did is going to decrease. And so again, if you seek approval, you're ultimately going to be let down. Because even if you have it, even if you're like, well, people like me now, well, what's it going to take for them to like you tomorrow? And if you had to do this grand gesture, if you had to go to this party or do this thing or act a certain way for them to approve of you today, what are you going to have to do tomorrow, the next day? Why are you seeking something that you can have in the perfection of the acceptance of God? It's foolishness, right? And no matter how great a president we have, the thing that, you know what people do have a long memory for? Misdeeds. Failures. People have a really long memory for failures. You know, you could do just one bad thing in school, and people are going to remember that till you graduate. Man, if you could be a straight-A student, be like a star football player and stuff like that, man, if you like pee your pants in class, everyone's going to remember you for that. No one's going to remember all the stuff that you did that was good, but everyone's going to remember that one thing that you did, you know? Because people have a really long memory for bad things, but not really for good things, because we're negative. And that's kind of what Solomon's saying. Solomon did more for Israel than any king before him or after him would ever do. He did so much for Israel. But even at the end of his life, people were like, ah, you know, his taxes are really high. And you know how much he did for those people? You know how much he expanded their boundaries? How much wealth he accumulated in Israel and how much better he made their lives? But even after all that, they're just like, ah, you know, he's all right. You know, at the time he was doing all those good things, people were like, man, we love Solomon. But the second those good things started to come, the second the boundaries stopped expanding, the second the economy started to level out, people were just like, ah, you know, David was so much better though, you know? And while Bush was in, you know, a bunch of people freaking hated Bush. Then the second he gets out and Obama comes in, they're like, oh man, the good old days with Bush. Why? Because people are just negative, man. Don't seek their approval. You're never going to find it. And seek someone else's approval. Seek the one who already has given you that approval. And we live our lives for an audience of one. For someone who's already accepted us. And that's what makes everything worth it. Now going on to chapter 5. Walk prudently then, go to the house of God, draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth and let your heart utter anything hastily before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore let your words be few. For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. And so Solomon, this is just him observing the church. And he's like, the church is hypocrites. That's basically what he's saying. He's saying the church is just a bunch of people that just go in there and they pray because they think that, what did Jesus say when he came on the scene? They think by their many words they're heard by God. You think that God is so fickle, so foolish, that because your prayer has a certain length, that he's going to hear it, whereas if you prayed something short and simple that was really from the heart, he wouldn't hear it. If I just came to God and be like, God, help me, and that's it. That was my whole prayer. Be like, well, God wouldn't possibly listen to that. I got to explain to him the entire situation, and I got to tell him exactly what I'm doing about it and exactly what I want to happen. I need to lay out everything for him because I want him to understand. And I need to have it a bar graph and all these things. God's like, dude, I don't need any of that, man. Dude, I don't need any of that. I know exactly what's happening in your life better than you do. Why do you need to explain something that I already know? That's what Jesus said. Dude, just, you know, when you go, just pray this. Our Father, art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. On earth as it is in heaven. Notice, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. How often do you pray that in your prayers? How often do you pray, God, I just want what you want for me. Instead of being like, God, this is the situation, and this is how I want it to work out. And it would be really cool if this worked out. And God, I want to really, this is what I want, man. And this is what I want, and you just keep praying what you want, what you want, what you want, and you never die to yourself and live for God. Not ever. Because it's all about you. I want to get out of this school. I want to go here. I want to get out of this family. I want to live by myself. I want this amount of money. I want this job. I want this relationship. It's all about you. Maybe that's why your prayers are useless. I mean, that's why you feel like you're praying to yourself. Because you are. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Notice the majority of Jesus' prayer is focusing on the glory and majesty of God. And then after he focuses, man, how big is my God? Then I focus on the small problems I have. Give us today our daily bread. Man, Lord, satisfy me with what I need today. Just for today. Man, you got tomorrow. You have the past. I just want to be satisfied in you today. I want to know what it means to love you today. Make that happen. Man, forgive me my trespasses. Notice the assumption of Jesus is every single time you pray it, you've blown it again. Isn't that cool? Jesus just assumes, man, the next time you pray it, you're gonna have messed up. Before you even if you prayed two times in a row, dude, you're gonna mess up between those two times. Doesn't matter. You suck. Like, get over it. Like, you know, like, Jesus doesn't care. He paid the price. Why are you feeling guilty about something that he already paid the price for? But how often after I sin am I like, oh, I can't go to God? Dude, I can't pray right now, man. I just view porn, dude. I need to wait like 4 days, and I need to like just fast, and then I can come to God. He already knows you blew it. He knew you blew it before you even blew it. He's okay with that. He died for you in your sins. He's pulled you out of your sins. Why would his love for you decrease now that you're out of your sins? It's foolishness, yet we don't do it. Man, forgive me my trespasses. God, I did just blow it. God, I'm blowing it right now. I need you right now. You know? And then what? Forgive others, right? Forgive others as you've forgiven me. Now I'm going to focus on, God, how do I be more like you? How do I be more like you, God? Because I don't want to be like me anymore. Because me is wickedness. In me, nothing good dwells. I don't want to be this proud, selfish person for the rest of my life. I want to serve others. I want to be like you. Show me how to live like you. Show me how to be anointed with the oil of gladness more than my companions. That's how Jesus was. Jesus was the happiest, most content person to ever exist. And yet in Isaiah 53, it says he was a man of sorrows acquainted with grief. How do we reconcile those? Maybe it's because the joy that Jesus had wasn't dependent on his circumstances, but it was dependent on the presence of God in his life. And is that how I look at my life? I have nothing, but I have the love of God, so I have everything. And or am I always looking for physical things to satisfy my needs? Because I'm foolish. Man, I come to God and I offer the sacrifice of fools. And thank God that it says that the Holy Spirit is praying for me too. Because if it was just based on my prayers, man, my life would be a wreck. But God knows better than me what I need. And that's why he prays for me. And he says, man, you don't even know the right words to say. But it's okay. And I just like hearing your voice. Man, I just like you coming to me. Even if you say the wrong thing, I like you coming to me. Okay, but I want to work on that. I don't want you to stay the way you are. I don't want you to just be like, man, well, I'm always this way, so, you know. God, this is always the way I've prayed, so I'm just going to keep praying, man, and stay the course. It's like, dude, no, I want you to be better than you are. I want to show you what you can become through my spirit. You're not going to be the same old person anymore. That person is dead. And you don't have to worry and fear and be like, man, I don't want this old person to come back out. I don't want this old negativity to come back out of me, and this old selfishness and this old lustfulness. And when I'm tempted and I fall, I think, man, I'm becoming the same old person. Well, no, you're not. You're a brand new person, but yeah, you blew it, but we all blow it. The righteous man falls 7 times, but he gets back up. But the wicked will fall by calamity. And are you going to fall those 7 times, but are you going to get back up those 7 times? That's what makes you righteous. We all fall. It's so important that we understand that. And guess what else? If I don't confess my sins to you, you're not going to feel comfortable confessing your sins to me. I had a woman on the phone that called me, and she was kind of easing her way in. She was talking about some things, and she was like, man, I'm not a good person. I was just like, hey, you know what? I'm not a good person either. I struggle with pornography. I'm really sick. I mean, it's not a past struggle. This is a current struggle in my life. She's like, man, I'm so glad that you said that. And then she opened up about her life. Why? Because we're so afraid of being judged. Man, and that's another important thing about this too. Don't offer the sacrifice of fools to each other. And don't just dominate a conversation. Be like, oh man, I think this person's hurting, so I'm going to get my 2 cents in. And I know this person's struggling with sin, so I'm just going to say whatever's on my heart. And be quick to listen. Really listen to what's going on in that person's life. And if you find someone in your life, by the way, that really truly listens to you, that's a special thing. That's something that God has given that person. That's not something they could do on their own. There's a movie, it's one of my favorite movies. It's called Fight Club. Really bad movie, don't watch it. But like, there's this part, this guy, he gets addicted to going to support groups for people who are dying. And when someone asked, like, cancer and all these other things, and someone asked him, you know, like, why do you go? And he says, because when people think you're dying, they actually listen to you instead of just waiting for their turn to speak. And so often when you talk to people, isn't that how it is? They're, like, nodding and listening, but they're just waiting to get their two cents in. And isn't that how you are when you're talking to someone instead of just listening? And how much different will our lives be when your treasure is found in just listening to another person? And isn't it something so special when someone's like, man, how are you doing? And you could really see genuine care in their eyes. Like, man, this person really honestly wants to know how I'm doing. And don't look for people who do that for you. Be the person who does that. You know, that's the important thing. That's what God can do for you. Don't offer the sacrifice of fools. Don't come with your many words. Come to listen. And that's more valuable. Do not let your mouth cause you, your flesh, to sin. Nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity. But fear God. And now there's a problem going on in Jesus' day where people were always like swearing unto God. They would be like, man, God, I'm going to do this great thing. And you know, if I don't do it, take my house. And they were doing all these things. And Jesus is like, dude, just let your yes be yes and your no be no. Stop it. I don't want your house, okay? I don't want your grand gesture because you're doing it for other people. You're not doing it for me. You're coming into church being like, and if that's what you need, if people are just like, man, this dude is so dishonest, then unless he makes this sweeping declaration, then I can't take him seriously, then maybe you should work on something else. Maybe you should just work on being honest. Be the little things, right? Man, when you say you're going to be somewhere, be there. And don't just cut out and be like, well, it's not a big deal. Man, you know what? That adds up. Okay, when someone wants to depend on you for a big thing, show that you could be dependent upon for the little things, the littlest things. And don't think nothing is small. Nothing is insignificant. Man, everything you do matters. Man, just take the weight of that in your heart and just be like, man, I should really pursue, especially people who look up to me. Do I want them to end up just like me? That make promises and then just don't keep them. Man, that just say, man, I care about you and I love you, but then the next day I show them something completely different from what my words have said. You know, are my actions reflecting what my words say? Man, or is it all vanity? Like Solomon says, man, it's all vanity. Your words are causing you to sin. And guess what? That's not just the Old Testament. In the New Testament, Ananias and Sapphira, they were struck dead because they lied to God. And what did Peter say? Dude, when you had, what they did is they sold their house and they took a portion of the profits for themselves and they gave a portion to the temple. But they told everyone that they gave them the entirety of their profits. So Peter said, man, when your house was yours, you didn't have to sell it. God never asked you to sell it. When you had the profits, you can give us whatever amount you wanted to. Your sin was that you lied about it. When you come to God, don't lie. Don't think that he doesn't know. Don't try to soften things. Tell him the truth. Man, if you're angry at someone, tell God you're angry at someone. Don't try to be this ultra-righteous person. God knows your heart. God, I just love this person so much. No, you don't. He's up in heaven just sneering at that person. Just like, dude, I know you hate him. Why are you lying to me? Just be honest. And don't give the sacrifice of fools. Fear God. Not a multitude of words, man, both in heaven and on earth. Love God, love people. That's what it's all about. That's what the entirety of the commandments are all about. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in the province, do not marvel at the matter. For high officials watch over high officials and higher officials over them. So here's Solomon at the top. And he's like, dude, if you see oppression and wickedness going on, don't marvel. Okay? It's always happened. It always will happen. Here I am the king, and I still can't control everything that goes on. People are still wicked underneath me. Higher officials watch over higher officials. Man, I have to hire people. I can't do everything. And of course, there's always going to be a bad nut in the bag. Okay, there always will be. Okay, so when I'm looking at the government being like, man, I can't believe the American government's so jacked up. Well, what did you expect, man? Are you perfect? So why do you think that perfect people should rule over you? Why do you deserve that? Okay, you're imperfect. You're ruled over by imperfect people. That's the way that it is. Okay? What we should do as Christians is not focus on what's going on in D.C. and freak out every single time that something happens. Man, focus on what is truly important. God has them. You know what? Higher officials watch over higher officials, but the highest official watches over them, and they will receive an account. They will give an account for everything they've done. So don't worry about them receiving justice. Worry about you. What are you doing to live quiet and peaceably a life as unto God? That's what 1 Timothy 2 says. Man, pray about that. Pray for the people who are above you, man. You know, they have a lot of responsibility. They may not be treating it right, but man, that's okay. Pray that they do treat it right. Because one day they're going to have to give an account, and that's going to be to much, who much is given, much is required. And I don't want to be President Obama on Judgment Day. He has to give an account for every decision that he has made and how it affected the millions of people that God gave him to rule over. That's rough. I don't want that. Luckily, I only have like 10 people I'm going to give an account for. That's good. I like that. All right. But, you know, in God's whole mentality is like, dude, just pray for these people, man. They need your prayers. They may be doing things wrong, but pray that they do things right. Because in all that they get and all that they gain, it's all vanity. And I have something better for them because I love them too. And live like that. And don't marvel at these things. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all. Even the king is served from the field. So Solomon saw the importance of manual labor. And he was one of the first officials to see this. You know, if the workers aren't happy, nobody is happy. And because if the workers aren't happy, then they're not going to do the right thing. They're not going to produce for the entire country. So Solomon understood to take care of things. That's why he was more focused on increasing the economy and things like that. That's just a piece of wisdom that Solomon had. It's a piece of wisdom. It's not really, you have no real application for it in your own life. I mean, unless you become a boss or a CEO or something like that. Or if there are ever any other people underneath you, you know, just take care of the people that God puts underneath you and love them. Okay? Because that's what God would want from you. Okay? But it goes on. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? I like that. When goods increase, so do people who eat them. Okay, when you start doing well, people are going to notice and you're going to have some hangers on. Okay, when you start having profit, you're going to have a lot of fair weather friends who are all about you when you're doing good and that you can buy them things and you can provide for them and things like that. But the second that your money dries up, you're going to be like the prodigal son. You're going to be all alone. So Solomon says, dude, don't worry about silver. Don't worry about abundance. Just worry about being satisfied, you know? And that's what he says. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet. Whether he eats little or much, the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. Why? Because again, like we talked about, a poor man doesn't have anything to worry about. If you're single and you're broke and things like that, Solomon would be like, dude, you're in a good place. Nobody depends on you. That's awesome, okay? If you blow it, the only person that suffers is you. But then you get married and you have kids, and guess what? Your decisions affect your whole family. Now you have responsibility, okay? You have a business, guess what? Now your employees depend on you, right? The decisions you make matter. It's like, dude, I would rather just be some broke, just dude living off nothing, paycheck to paycheck, than to be where I'm at right now. And so if that's where you're at right now, man, someone would be like, dude, that's awesome. You know, be happy, be satisfied with where you're at, that you don't have responsibility. That's a good thing. You know, as time increases, God will give you responsibilities. He knows you can handle it. He's not gonna make you just like the CEO of a major business overnight, okay? If he makes you that, it's because he understands you can handle that. God will never give you anything you can't handle. Okay, but just be satisfied and content with the season that you're in right now. If you have much, be content with the much. If you have little, be content with the little. Don't be seeking to be in a position that you're not at yet. There's so much that God wants to do in the here. Don't be looking for the then. You don't even know if you have a then. This could be the last time we ever talk, man. Jesus can come back before this sermon ends, and that would be awesome. You know, so be content where you're at. And then he says, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There's severe evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And this is also a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All the days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. So again, he details a man who lives for the now. He says, man, this man is worthless. It's something that he's gone over before, so we're not going to get into that. But verse 18, here's what I've seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all of his labor, in which he toils under the sun, and the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. And so now we see a contrast. Here's a guy who lives for himself, and here's a guy who lives for God. Whether he has little or whether he has much, he has everything in God. And everything is a joy to him because he serves someone greater than himself. My life is no longer purposeless. It serves the one with ultimate purpose and meaning, who gives me that purpose and meaning. See, that changes everything about your life. See, now you're not defined by who you are in the business world. That's what everyone else in the world sees, right? The first question, once you make it past the age of 18, the first question that any guy is going to ask you is, what do you do for a living? Because that's what defines you. That's who you are to this person now. Why trade stocks? Well, you're a stockbroker. Well, there's other parts of my life. Well, I don't care. You're a stockbroker, right? They label you. Oh, you're a student. Girls, oh, you're this. You're a secretary. You're a CEO. You're a boss. You're blah, blah, blah. You're a mom. That's your definition because that's what you do, right? Girls don't tend to ask that as much as guys, though, because they really don't care. But guys tend to ask that a lot because that's how we define other men. But the problem is, if that's your definition, what happens if that definition gets taken away from you? Which it will. Eventually, you're going to retire. The number one killer of old people is retirement. Did you know that? People who retire, they spend all their lives saving up for retirement. They're like, man, I can't wait to retire. I'm going to sail the world. I'm going to do all these things. They retire. Then they realize my life has no more meaning because my meaning was founded in my job. And then they die like a year later. It's an interesting thing. It's weird. You can look it up statistically. People who retire, they die like within the next couple of years. Within like 5 years, most people die after retirement because they define themselves as their job, you know, or as a relationship. And people who just lose the will to live after a relationship goes away. And my wife died, so I never move on. My kids left the house, so I'm just going to sulk for my entire life. That's sad. But if I'm defined as a child of God, I'm a servant of the Almighty. I mean, everything that I do in life, now it changes. I don't do the things to be something. I do the things because I already am something. Man, yeah. I like this job. Man, it may not be a great job. It's a minimum wage thing. But you know what? It's a way to provide for myself. God has given me a means to provide for myself. I don't have high expectations of what I deserve. I need this to be happy. I'm happy where I'm at. Man, as a husband and a father, that'd be the greatest thing that you could ever do. Man, I have the ability to provide for my family. That's awesome. Man, who cares? I work at McDonald's. So what? You provide for your wife and your family. Who cares where you work? You know, if you have an abundance, that's bad. But if you have just, man, I just want to provide for their needs and I'm going to work my butt off and I'm going to do what God has called me to do, that's different. That's something that you should strive for because you're not defined by what you do. You're defined by who you are in God. And that makes things so much different. Now I'm not striving for jobs. Now I'm not striving for position. I'm only striving to know God more and more, that his love can abound in me, that I could be a reflection of his glory on earth, that his joy could be perfected in who I am. And I'm going to real quick go through chapter 6. There's not much in here, but I need to get through it. I got like 2 minutes, but I got it. All right. There's an evil which I have seen under the sun and is common among men, a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires. Yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity and it is an evil affliction. Again, if you live for yourself, someone else is just going to take it eventually, so it doesn't really matter. If a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his soul of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. For it is better in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice, but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place. And some people think that the longevity of life, that will make him happy. Man, if I die at 20, that would really suck. And Solomon's like, dude, it would be better if you didn't live a single day than if you live 2,000 years and you don't understand the meaning of life. And 2,000 years lived for vanity is worse than just, man, you didn't even see the outside of your mom's womb. That would have been better. But man, if you see the purpose of life, if you see the beauty that is in God, and it doesn't matter if you live to 10 or if you live to 100, every single day is going to be precious because you're living for something greater than yourself. And All the labor of a man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. For what more is a wise man than a fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. In other words, what he's saying is, it's better to have a little of what you can actually obtain than to desire much that you can never obtain. And don't covet, right? That's in the law. Don't covet. You know, God, why does God make the law for us? He makes it for your sake. Did you know that? When he tells you to do something, it's for your own sake. Hey, don't go off and sleep with 1,000 chicks like Solomon did. Why? Because it wrecked his life. Hey, don't pursue all these earthly pleasures, because in the end, it's only going to be vanity. Don't kill people, because in the end, you're going to realize that your murderous heart is wicked, and it's going to separate you and segregate you from everyone that you loved. Don't do that. You know, just be who God has called you to be. Follow his commandments. And one of the things he's commanded us to do is do not covet. Do not desire what you do not have. Because even in the obtaining of it, there's only vanity. And just be satisfied and content with what God has given you. Man, the desire of your eyes. And just be satisfied with what you can see. And be happy with what God has given you. Whatever one is, he has been named already. For it is known that he is man, and he cannot contend with him who is mightier than he. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? For who knows what is good for man in life, all the days of his vain life, which passes like a shadow? Who can tell a man what will happen to him after the sun? So it ends on a pretty low note, right? And after you die, no one can tell you what's going to happen after you die. So again, live for God, and live for the things that are in him. You know, don't covet, don't desire what you can't have. You know, the grass could be green on this side, and you can be satisfied and content in him. And that's all I got for you guys. Got through 4 chapters today. That's pretty cool, right? Yeah?